turn, the other person may feel used. They are unwittingly involved in a process the narcissist is using to feel okay in the world, Eatonson said. The narcissist's behavior cries out, "Complete me." The unrequited lover overlooks her impact as she martyrs herself to love. She is in such pain that she can't reckon with the consequences of what she's doing. When the unwanted woman cries, "I can't help it," she abandons her free will and her judgment, fundamental aspects of her humanity. When Tilly, a retail buyer in Northern Virginia, Googled Martin, she was 51 and hadn't dated since her painful divorce 13 years before. She was too hurt by the end of her marriage and too busy raising her three children as a single mother. The idea of Martin, her ex-boyfriend from 25 years ago, simply insisted itself one day, for what felt like no particular reason. She discovered his blog. He had recently posted an article about losing his longtime job at a radio station in Colorado. It was the same job he'd had when they were together. She found out from earlier postings that he'd had a minor stroke the year before. She hadn't planned on rekindling anything. She was worried about him and emailed him through his blog to find out whether he was okay. He wasn't. He called later that day to tell her that he had just gotten biopsy results back. He had a malignant lung tumor. What followed that phone call was, as Tilly described it, 3.5 months of romantic emails and long-distance conversations. She visited him once. She slept at a friend's home and spent her days with Martin. They took long drives on the scenic roads near his home and talked endlessly. They remained chaste, but the visit felt emotionally intimate. She is an observant Christian, and they spent a lot of time discussing spirituality. As his health continued to falter, she urged him closer to God and convinced him to reconnect with an estranged sister. He sent her roses on her birthday. She held out hope that he would recover and want a serious relationship with her. Everyone wanted it to work out, she said. It would have been a fairy tale. But then the fairy tale went off script. Martin had been doing well on chemotherapy, but the treatments started to wear him down. His breathing sounded labored. He told her he had gotten too weak to cook an egg. He still called her every day, but he sounded less patient. He made surly remarks to her. "I was feeling rejected," Tilly said. She tentatively asked if he thought they should take a break from the phone calls. He said yes and hung up on her. "We never spoke again," she said. After that conversation, Tilly entered the masochistic zone. She pleaded with Martin not to cut her off. She left several messages on his phone. "I felt like I couldn't breathe," she said. "My stomach hurt. I said, 'Please call me. I feel ill.'" He responded by email. She was crazy, he wrote, and he couldn't deal with her anymore. "I was trying to respect him, but I couldn't handle the hope of a future with someone and then have it snatched away," she said. "I felt such a sense of worth with him. I felt sick when that was yanked away." A crisis counselor to whom she reached out through a 24-hour mental health hotline reassured her that her grief was justified, given how suddenly Martin had pulled away. However understandable her emotions, it's important to look closely at her reaction and the nature of her love for Martin. The distance between them and the additional limits of his illness left a lot of room for her fantasy to grow. All she had was his voice on the phone and a regular stream of emails to feed her ideas about how perfect they would be together. At first, they both benefited. He needed her support. She got a lot out of being supportive. The relationship gave her an outlet for her strengths, her insight and her compassion. As so many unrequited lovers do, she tied up the prospect of a more serious relationship with a critical life goal, ending her long years of loneliness and single mother martyrdom. Initially, her love seemed to be headed to that starry future. Even if their romance were curtailed by his death, she would be his final love, a grace in his last days. When Martin cut off contact with her, he disrupted that fantasy. "To come that close to the dream of my heart and have it taken away from me was overwhelming," Tilly said. As she was swept up in the protest response of the newly abandoned, she lost perspective. Her sick feeling took precedence over his worsening cancer, as if her life were ending too. She described the end of their relationship in fatal terms. To open up to someone again and have him kill you was hard. She was swept up in what Molloy calls the sense of entitlement that can emerge from fantasies about the beloved. Tilly told me that after a few days, she gave up and stopped calling him. But she held out hope that he would get better and reconnect. He sent her 2 curt emails informing her of his worsening condition. A few months later, Martin's ex-wife told Tilly that he was dead. At his funeral, a friend of his told Tilly how important she was to him after he got his diagnosis, and this news gave her some peace. "I couldn't let him go until he died," she said. "After that, there was no possibility that he was going to call me." In the literary realm, self-sacrifice in its most extreme form, suicide, seems the ultimate expression of unrequited love. The publication in 1774 of Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther, the story of a man who kills himself over his obsession with a woman who marries someone else, caused a rash of copycat suicides. Some of the men who killed themselves were found dressed like Werther or with the book open to the passage detailing his death. Germaine de Staël's 1802 epistolary novel Delphine overtly presents its protagonist as a female Werther, grappling with an amour passion that is suffocated by the social priorities of the day. Delphine takes poison when she finds out the fiery Spaniard she loves is sentenced to death for his association with the old regime in revolutionary-era France. This kind of plotline comes from the Romantic era's lionization of extreme states of feeling and political heroism. Suicide is imagined as a mystical release from social oppression and romantic disappointment. The fascination over suicides caused by unrequited love became a full-blown cliché in the Victorian era. Stories of pining, suicidal women were common in broadsheets and annuals. They were figures of pity, victims of men who had more status, power, or strength than they did. In The Suicide, a poem in a holiday annual, Ida, abandoned by her beloved in favor of a wealthier bride, walks into the sea to drown herself. A plunge was heard, a dying groan, a bubble in the moonbeam shone. The trope of the suicidal unwanted woman, which persisted despite the fact that women had a lower suicide rate than men, reinforced the idea of the emotionally dependent woman. If a man was to be a woman's main reason for living, losing him was portrayed as a reason to end her life. These stories also served as cautionary tales, since the economic and political reality of the time was that many women couldn't live much of a life without a man. Unless they came from substantial privilege, they'd risk drowning in poverty and social stigma. This risk is much diminished today. Yet, even in the era of romantic practicality, There's plenty of intrigue with the idea that suicide is the supreme gesture of lovelorn recklessness. I've listened to a car full of tween girls belting out Bruno Mars's Grenade, a pop song about catching an explosive and diving in front of a train for the sake of a hard-hearted beloved. When I asked them about it, all of them agreed vehemently that this sort of behavior was stupid. No one will develop self-destructive urges just because a tune on the radio makes it sound catchy. But the song and those suicide narratives of yore do tap into something real. If the unwanted woman gets mired in the delusion that her beloved's attention is the only thing that validates her, the lack of it could send her into a precariously fragile state. Carolyn, 24, came from a conservative Christian family in western Pennsylvania. As she entered adulthood, she fell away from the religion and started to come out as a lesbian. Two of her siblings refused to eat with her, quoting a Bible passage from Corinthians that admonishes the faithful not to take meals with unbelievers. Another sibling stopped talking to her. She lived in fear that her parents supported her only out of a sense of Christian duty to see her through college. Once she earned her degree, she worried they would disown her. At college, she found herself in a completely different world. She studied film and animation at an elite art school in New England. Most of her fellow students struck her as snobbish, unwilling to be friendly because she was slightly older. In class discussion, she perceived them as competitively pretentious. One afternoon, during a break in her directing class, she exchanged exasperated glances with Gus, a classmate. It was like, "Oh, please, we have to go back in and face those people." He seemed a kindred spirit, and her heart jumped. They became friends and worked on films together. The last day of class, everyone presented a final project. She was startled to see that Gus's film was full of references to her life. He knew she loved 1980s music and YouTube videos of owls, and she often complained to him that she had a terrible memory. The film featured a female character in an owl mask dancing to 1980s music. Later in the film, Gus's character, speaking off-screen, asks the dancer, "Do you remember we did this?" She replies, "I don't remember what you're talking about." Carolyn didn't say a word during the discussion that followed, but then I was like, "He knows what he did," she said. "He made this person based off of me to show me how much he loves me. I convinced myself of that." She was euphoric. She spent hours on social media, reading every tweet and status update he posted. She read all his likes and favorites. She posted as much as she dared on his Facebook wall, messaged him ideas and links, and sent out tweets in hopes that he would respond. "I would obsess over what I was going to say to him to make sure it was perfect," she said. "I felt this terror that I was going to say something wrong. I wasn't messaging him constantly, but I spent a lot of time figuring out what I was going to say. I'd be lying in bed, taking a shower, getting coffee, and thinking about what I should post next." She wanted him to see that she was different, so he would want to be with her. What exactly she desired was hard to define. She knew he was also gay. "It was another thing we had in common," she said. Sometimes she would fantasize about kissing him, though she didn't want to sleep with him. Her focus was on his eyes, his face, and his words, not his body. "I fantasized about us living together and having a close, intimate relationship, but not a sexual relationship. I would be his one true friend. Other people could have sex with him, but we would always be together," she said. "I wanted him to be a part of my family, a family that I would make." Carolyn spun a dire web of meaning around Gus. She wanted him to be family because her own family was rejecting her, but he couldn't offer her that closeness. When he didn't respond to the ideas she emailed and texted, she was devastated. She stopped looking for traffic before she crossed the street. She drove to the ocean and, just like the tragic heroine of the suicide, walked into the frigid water. A sandbar prevented her from going out too far. Another time, she got drunk and walked to an abandoned drawbridge on the outskirts of the city in the middle of the night. The bridge had been stuck in the open position since it went out of use in the 1970s. She climbed to the top of the open bridge and walked on the narrow ledge high above the river. She told herself she was daring fate. If she fell, that meant she was supposed to die. The myth that fictions such as Werther and The Suicide perpetuate is that romantic rejection alone leads to suicidal behavior. Though the loss of love is a common factor, a central principle of mental health risk management is that untreated depression is the main cause, and no single life event can be pinpointed as the only trigger for suicide. Carolyn's self-destructive impulses were at the center of many risk factors. She was socially isolated and had a tenuous connection to her family. She was impulsive and sensitive and struggled with depression. She was drinking, and she took Gus's silences as a rejection of who she was. Finally, Carolyn found a way to express what she was feeling instead of using it against herself. At the end of the school year, she offered to drive Gus to the airport. They met for breakfast beforehand, and she gave him a diary full of love poems. "I had to do something," she said. "My feelings were driving me crazy. It had been this secret. I thought that if he was aware of how I felt, then I could deal with it." She didn't see him at all over the summer. When they saw each other at school, he didn't say anything about the diary. Instead of being devastated, she realized at last that the relationship she dreamed of wasn't going to happen. She was no longer consumed with provoking responses from him, and the drawbridge no longer called to her. Carolyn and I first spoke about a year after her obsession ended. I followed up with her 3 years later. She was living in Colorado, far from her western Pennsylvania hometown, but she told me that her relationship with her parents had improved. They hadn't disowned her, as she had feared. We talked about how her obsession with Gus had changed her approach to relationships. She said she now handles rejection in a much more stable way. She's learned to be wary when someone makes her feel the way she first felt with Gus, elated and suddenly confident. "I take a step back and think, why do I feel that?" she said. "I try to talk to the person and learn more about them." The process, she described, seemed to be about breaking down that initial powerful narcissistic fantasy. The person she's attracted to, she now realized, won't complete her, and with her more reflective approach, she might be able to see that person more clearly. Facing my own narcissism has pushed me to consider something I couldn't consider when I was obsessed, the impact of my actions on B. It's likely he felt harassed and confused, beset by the moral dilemma of the rejector. He very well might have felt violated, angry, frightened, or worse. I'll never know. After my obsession ended, I decided not to seek him out for any reason, though for a while our proximity meant we ran into each other occasionally. Even now, I suspect that wanting anything from him might come across as invasive, even, perhaps especially, the answer to the question of what my obsession felt like to him. Yet I knew I needed a more comprehensive way to see outside the self-absorbed perspective of the unwanted woman who's lost herself to unrequited love. I've noticed in my survey responses, interviews, and casual conversations, a strong tendency to see the beloved as the self-centered and sadistic tormentor who won't give you the relief of returning your love. Though cruel manipulators do exist, no matter the character of the rejector, rejection will feel cruel and self-serving when you've got so much invested. I spent plenty of time when I was obsessed, seething about what B was doing to me. In retrospect, I don't think he was a cruel manipulator. He was confused and sometimes insensitive, but these are far lesser sins. With this new understanding of the unrequited lover's self-absorption, I felt I had to look at the problem from the other side. When the unwanted woman loses herself to the narcissism of unrequited love, what is the impact on the beloved who must witness her breakdown? After Renzo and his girlfriend broke up, he spent a lot of time with a group of fellow South American expats living in Manhattan. The split was unexpected and painful, and he needed their support and company. One of the women, Yoseline, grew particularly close to him. She took the role of good friend and mother because she felt I was lost, he said. She had a beautiful smile, and he told her so. They kissed and hugged every time they met. It was part of their culture, he said. He was affectionate with all his friends and generous with compliments to the opposite sex, and Yoseline was no exception. He walked her back to her apartment at the end of evenings out in what he regarded as a gentlemanly gesture. When she fell ill with shingles, he stopped by her apartment every day to take care of her. He enjoyed her friendship, but he wasn't attracted to her. Renzo, who is a composer, was so anguished over his breakup that he fell behind on writing a commissioned piece for a chamber orchestra. I knew I had to reorganize myself, he said. He threw himself into finishing the work. One afternoon, Yoseline stopped by his apartment while he was composing. He greeted her and explained that he had to keep working. She set about cooking a meal for him. After they ate, she asked him what else she could do to help him. He said she could mark measure numbers on the score. I trusted her hand, he said. She did it perfectly. He would come to regret accepting her offer of help. But at the time, he was absorbed in trying to finish the piece. I just thought she was helping me, as I had helped her when she was sick, he said. The evening the piece was performed, Yoseline behaved as though she were part of the composer, as if she understood what I had gone through to write the piece, as if she knew what the piece was about, Renzo said. It was as if she was my wife and part of the process. That did not go over well with me. A few days later, he returned to his apartment to find his voicemail full of messages from his friends asking if he was okay. He noticed some of his papers were out of place. He discovered that Yoseline had convinced all their friends and the super of his apartment building that Renzo intended to kill himself in the bathtub. The super had let her into the apartment to check on Renzo while he was out. She came back later to tell him what she had done. I got really mad, because it was an imposition, and she was doing something that was not for her to do, out of some dream of the woman who helps the artist, he said. Yoseline's calls and visits increased. She wrote letters to his siblings abroad. She even visited his parents, who lived near Renzo in Manhattan. Her message was twofold. She warned them that Renzo was emotionally and mentally weak, and she confessed to them that she could not live without him. Renzo began to avoid his home. He had a first-floor apartment and knew she could see the light from the street whenever he was inside. He stopped going out with their group of friends. He was afraid to pick up the telephone. When he started dating another woman, Yoseline became even more distraught. She cried whenever she saw them together. One afternoon, he was staring out his front window, as he often did, and saw her on the street. Their eyes met, and he felt he had to open the door. She handed him a bunch of flowers. Then she lay down on the floor and began to cry. Again and again, she asked how he could be seeing someone else. "We had something that was so beautiful," she protested. She sobbed and cursed and asked the same question repeatedly. He sat on the couch and watched her. He tried to explain that they had never been more than friends, but he couldn't stop her lament or get her to leave. It was the first of several visits when she would lie prostrate in distress. Even though he knew he wasn't to blame for her behavior, he regretted the encouragement he unwittingly had given, the affection, the compliments, and most of all, his acceptance of her offer of help. "I should have used my eyes better and been more careful," he said. We can see through Yoseline's eyes the hope she placed in his early affection and acts of kindness. Being cared for when you are sick is a classic marker of intimacy and commitment. In sickness and in health, the wedding vows say. But that's also what good friends do. Renzo saw his caretaking only as an expression of friendship, which at the time he badly needed. Research on unrequited love shows that these different interpretations are very common. One side values the growing friendship, the other reads it as a build-up to romance. Yoseline's misreading grew to surreal proportions, to the point where she deluded herself into believing that Renzo wanted to kill himself and needed her to save him. This is where she lost herself. Even though Renzo hasn't seen Yoseline in 15 years, the image of her on the floor keeps coming back to him. He remembers the numbers on the clock as he went to let her in, 12:45. He remembers what she was wearing, a white shirt and a blue skirt. And he remembers that she lay down right inside the door, as if she couldn't go any farther. "I hated that," he said. Through his eyes, we can imagine how excruciating it must have been to watch her lying there. You would want to do anything to make her leave, but in the face of so much vulnerability, there are no good options. "It was difficult for me to see a person crumble like that and become something so small," he said. Renzo could not be the person Yoseline fantasized about, the lover, composer, compatriot, partner. In losing herself to the narcissism of unrequited love, she experienced this disappointment so acutely that she couldn't, as Renzo so aptly put it, see herself again. But what happened to Yoseline was Renzo's loss, too. After his new relationship grew serious and eventually led to marriage, Yoseline left him alone. He was greatly relieved. Yet he also mourns for the Yoseline he knew before she lost herself. She was his friend and a part of the community that helped him out at a difficult time in his life. He had believed in the value of the warm ways of his homeland, embodied in her and the friends with whom they used to drink wine and go salsa dancing. She had everything in her to be this wonderful human being, he said. Renzo could not be the person to restore her to her strengths. He hopes she found a way to do it herself. 6. The gender pass. Female stalkers and their invisible victims. In the wake of my obsession with B, I met a graphic designer and visual artist I'll call Patricia. She was in her mid-50s with expensively tinted blonde hair. She had grown up in Georgia and wore the air of a former Southern belle, but with a proud, don't-mess-with-me edge. One evening I told her about my unrequited love and the lengths it drove me to. "Honey," she said, That was nothing. She proceeded to tell me about the affair she began when she was 39. At the time, she was living outside San Francisco. She was married and had a 9-year-old son. Her family began to take sailing lessons, but her husband didn't take to the sport. So she continued the lessons alone. She found sailing exhilarating. "I felt refreshed after a race," she said. "I'd spent myself physically, hauling sails, water in my face. It was much better than seeing a shrink, and cheaper, too." One evening at the marina, she met a man she asked me to call Wolf for his loner spirit and ruggedness. They had what she described as a strong intellectual rapport, which meant a lot to her. She had a college degree, but had been raised to treat higher education as a means to find a husband. She had always felt insecure about her intelligence. Wolf, who lived in a converted tack house on a ranch, seemed to be everything her corporate husband was not. The affair lasted over a year. He pressured her to leave her husband, but she refused. He grew insistent and aggressive. Once, he hit her so hard that she fell to the floor. Another time, he wouldn't let her leave his house until the next day. She had no way to explain her absence to her husband, who'd been terrified about her disappearance. When Wolf told Patricia he didn't want to see her anymore, she couldn't accept it. She would go to the marina and lie in wait in his sailboat. She wrote fragments of Edna St. Vincent Millay poems in nail polish on the boat's beautiful wood. "I know what my heart is like since your love died." She stole things from the boat, including a sail. "I became like a predator," she said. "I wanted to catch his scent so I could feel near him." When Wolf began to see someone else, Patricia was consumed with jealousy. At night, after her husband fell asleep, she snorted cocaine, got into her Jaguar, and sped the 80 miles to confront Wolf. The drive ended on dusty, windy roads. She would park out of earshot and tiptoe to the house. Before she walked in on him, she peed near his front door to make my mark. She begged him to come back to her, but he resisted, telling her he was too involved with his new girlfriend. From time to time, he would relent and spend a night or a weekend away with Patricia. She rented a studio on an estuary for the two of them to escape to, but he never showed up. She discovered that he had gone to Lake Tahoe with his girlfriend for her family reunion. The news sent her into what she described as attack mode. "You're going to find this person and confront him, and nothing else matters," she said. She found out where he was staying by calling resorts in Lake Tahoe and claiming to be part of the family reunion. She rented a car she knew Wolf wouldn't recognize. She gave her husband the bizarre excuse that she had promised his father she would go to Sacramento to research his family's genealogy. She said she didn't care if he went with her, so he did. When they passed Sacramento, she explained they would be staying in Lake Tahoe, even though it was over 2 hours outside the city. Her husband didn't stop her. By now he had found out about Wolf and had tried to get her to stop seeing him. Patricia knew she was hurting her husband, but she couldn't stop herself from her chase. "It was all about me," she said. She rented a cabin near Wolf's. After her husband fell asleep, she went out to Wolf's cabin and began throwing rocks at it. She ran in circles, beating on the doors and the walls. "Come out! I know you're in there!" she yelled. "You think you can do this to me? We had plans!" A friend of Wolf's girlfriend came out and got into his car to go for the police. Patricia threw her body on the car hood to keep him from moving. She broke the windshield with a stick. He threw her off and drove away. She ran back to her cabin and told her husband they had to leave. After they got home, a police officer arrived with an arrest warrant. A restraining order was issued against her, and she had to pay damages for the smashed car. In the weeks that followed, squad cars regularly cruised by her house, not to monitor her, but to mock her. Police officers would roll down their windows, wiggle their tongues at her, and laugh. "The word was out," Patricia said. "I was a horn dog, a loose woman, available." When it wasn't that at all. She remained fixated on Wolf, her rage at his abandonment still vivid. She turned to her art to help her cope. She created a sculpture for an art show put on by the Gorilla Girls, a feminist art movement pushing for greater representation of work by female artists. The piece, which she called The Legend of the Lost Cause, included a copy of Dante's Inferno, her police report, a photographic image of Wolf superimposed with a hyena face, and a railroad spike going through a flaccid cloth penis. She took her husband and son to the opening. "People were looking at me like, 'This is your son, and he's looking at this?'" she remembered. "I was so self-absorbed, I failed to realize anyone else's feelings." The sculpture and Patricia's pride in it underscore the obliviousness that can come over women who cross the line and keep going, becoming stalkers. "The person appears to give little thought to their impact on the other," said forensic psychologist J. Reed Malloy. "That's how you can see the narcissism. They are dismissive or surprised when they're asked if they thought about the other person. In the most extreme cases, I hear things like, 'I don't care what he thinks. I'm going to have a relationship with him anyway.'" Unrequited love can be a potent and revealing manifestation of the wish to escape from an unhappy marriage, oppressive social mores, and other constraints. But while Patricia hooked her anger to a feminist movement, there is nothing liberating or feminist about real-life stalking. Even though Wolf had wronged and abused her, Patricia's pursuit of him was itself invasive and violent. But like the cops who teased her after her arrest, we tend to resist seeing the actions of Patricia and other women who stalk as cause for alarm. We'd rather give female stalkers the gender pass, telling ourselves what they're doing is funny or nutty and not really a problem. It's far more comfortable and comforting to mock their actions than to reckon fully with their impact. The dark side of the urge to pursue, no matter which gender is doing the chasing, is its potential for harm. Romantic pursuit, as we've seen, falls along a continuum. At one end are courtship initiatives with the risks, pleasures, and privileges of being the one who takes the lead. At the other is criminal stalking, which can ruin lives. H. Colleen Sinclair, a psychology professor at Mississippi State University, has done extensive research on this continuum. For her, the movement from courtship to stalking is clear, no matter who is the perpetrator. At one end of the continuum are everyday efforts, flirting, attentive emails and texts, phone calls, to form a relationship or reconcile one. Then there are surveillance and monitoring behaviors, when pursuers' motivations are a blend of love and anger. All along the way, frequency and degree matter. Is it one text a day or 100? A dozen roses or a roomful of them? Then there are the most extreme measures: trespassing, threats, harassment, coercion, and violence. At this point, there's no romance, she said. They are doing this to hurt. Once they move from surveillance to aggression, the line isn't blurry. Pursuers may tell themselves that their stalking is a form of love or courtship, she allowed, but that's just like we used to talk about a rapist as the guy who is overwhelmed with passion. Today, we have a similar myth about stalking. People think it's about being so in love you're not able to control yourself, Sinclair explained. But you're driven by retaliation and obsession rather than love and idealization. Once you're aggressive, you're not idealizing. You're not in love. All that's left is the obsession. Stalking is commonly seen as a crime against women, and for good reason. According to a 2010 National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence, NIPSV, survey, women are 3 times more likely than men to have been stalked. That still means plenty of male stalking victims. 1 in 19 men have been stalked, and about half reported their stalkers were female. The definition of criminal stalking varies somewhat from state to state, but the 3 main criteria for the crime are repeated, unwanted, and intrusive behaviors, implicit or explicit threats, and causing fear. The NIPSV study surveyed self-identified victims and was based on a definition of stalking that led them to feel very fearful or believe that they or someone in their life would be harmed or killed as a result. But intent and fear are often not clear in the complex dynamics of unwanted romantic and sexual pursuit. Targets may not feel the level of alarm the NIPSV study assessed. They may not perceive themselves as victims, even when they feel harassed and afraid. Pursuers may not see themselves as wanting to cause harm. If we set aside these questions and again turn our focus to a softer definition of stalking, the gender disparity markedly diminishes. Sinclair began to see this pattern emerge during her graduate studies in the 1990s, a time when anti-stalking laws were new. She'd gotten into the field out of an interest in what she had been calling violence against women. She had done stints volunteering at a battered women's shelter and on a rape crisis hotline. Yet the research she was working on, along with studies on other forms of relationship violence and abuse, was showing again and again that there were plenty of female aggressors and male victims, too many to see as aberrations. The idea that stalking was purely a matter of patriarchal terrorism didn't hold up. It was a change in perspective, she said. I don't refer to it as violence against women anymore. It's interpersonal violence or relationship aggression. Before, it had always been seen as a women's issue. Several peer-reviewed studies conducted since 2000 scrutinized the question of gender and unwanted pursuit. The results show that women are just as likely as men to engage in a number of stalking tactics, and even more likely to resort to certain kinds. In one study, approximately 1/3 of women reported using mild aggression, including threats, verbal abuse, and physical abuse, after a breakup, compared to about 1/4 of men. In another set of findings on obsessive relational intrusion, the rate of women who stole or damaged property was 2x the rate of men, and the rate of women who caused physical harm was almost 3x higher. Female pursuers were just as likely as male pursuers to resort to severe violence, such as kicking and choking. Criminology researcher Carlene M. Thompson pinpointed one possible reason that the level of female-perpetrated relationship pursuit violence is so high, a socio-cultural attitude that is more disapproving of male violence against women than female violence against men. Women, the research suggests, are giving themselves the gender pass. They may be more likely to feel they have a right to their behavior, while men, with the chivalry norm that stigmatizes violence against women, are more likely to know that, at least in principle, they shouldn't be getting out of hand. Researcher Leela Dutton at the University of New Haven has considered the possibility that one reason the rates of female stalking behaviors are so high is that women may feel less defensive about what they are doing. That makes them more comfortable than men are about reporting their pursuit behaviors in a survey, even though their identity remains anonymous. It's much less socially acceptable for a man to hit a woman, she said. We don't take women's violence as seriously, so women can get away with it. This assumption is compounded by the widespread impression that female stalkers of male targets don't cause real harm. Research into perceptions of stalking scenarios finds that respondents view female stalkers as less dangerous and problematic than male stalkers. Male victims of female stalkers are seen as better able to defend themselves than female victims. It's not hard to guess why the perceived scariness of male stalkers might overshadow the impact of female stalkers. Given that men have more privilege, power, size, and muscle, there's greater fear associated with their pursuit activities, said Jennifer Lang Henriksen Rowling, a clinical psychology professor at the University of South Alabama who studies relationship violence. But when we don't view female aggression as serious or noteworthy, women don't get feedback that their behavior is not okay. As several experts pointed out, the privilege, power, size, muscle rationale only goes so far once gender-neutral tools of the stalking trade enter the picture. How much weight a stalker can bench press doesn't matter in cyberspace or once she has a pistol in her hand. My own behavior with B was never violent or threatening, but I was invasive. When he opened his front door in response to my compulsive knocking, the tight, guarded look on his face and the sharp tone in his voice surprised me. I had become something he felt he needed to defend himself against. It took me a long time to admit that my pursuit of B could have been harmful. I saw what I was doing mainly as self-destructive. If I used the word stalking to describe my actions, it was always with some irony. It was only when I gender-flipped my experience that I could come to terms with what I did. When I envisioned a man acting as I had, I saw a creepy stalker, with nothing ironic about him. In my discussions with researchers and clinical psychologists, I discovered that they found gender-flipping a persuasive tool in getting women and girls to face the implications of female stalking. In one of H. Colleen Sinclair's psychology classes, her students insisted that Tiger Woods' ex-wife, Elin Nordegren, was justified in allegedly chasing him out of the house with a golf club and causing his SUV to crash, until Sinclair asked them to consider how they'd feel if Tiger had been the one wielding a golf club in a jealous fury. In a relationship violence prevention program run by Lang Henriksen Rowling and colleagues for low-income pregnant teens in Mobile, Alabama, several girls told stories of aggressively tracking and confronting the fathers of their children. The girls defended their behavior on the grounds that they suspected the fathers were cheating on them or had new girlfriends. The others in the group agreed with this reasoning. They tended to see female vengeance as exciting. They thought, yeah, she was really taking it to him, Lang Henriksen Rowling said. She countered by asking what they would think if they were listening to males telling the same stories. Over and over, I would pose hypotheticals and switch the gender, and we'd see perceptions change. In my interviews with women whose pursuit crossed the line between courtship and harassment, I found that their focus, like Patricia's, was usually on how they'd been wronged. They were seeking love, the truth, rightful retribution. They couldn't be hurting their beloved. He was the one hurting them. Psychotherapist Rhonda Findling, the author of Don't Text That Man, said, "They're so fixated on the other person, they don't even care about him. They don't care what he's saying." This narcissistic trance isn't unique to women. Yet while men fall into this trance despite strong social messages that warn them not to be aggressive, women don't have these cautions. They may even use the stereotype of the male aggressor as a weapon in their pursuit. Luke, a 55-year-old marketing director, first described Dara to me as the porch diver. She had become a family joke, a story he hauled out regularly. "I look at the whole thing with mild amusement. It's funny. It's a party story." He met Dara through an online dating service. They went out for margaritas. She told him that she had recently gone through a rough divorce. Her husband, she told Luke, had served her with papers when she was in the hospital, recovering from a serious accident. At the end of the evening, Luke said, in the noncommittal parlance of internet dating, that it had been nice to meet her. She replied with a question. "If you could ask me anything to do next, anything at all, what would you ask?" "I'm a guy and she's an attractive woman," he told me somewhat sheepishly. So I said, "Well, come home with me and go to bed with me." She came home with him, went to bed with him, and didn't leave. She immediately assumed all the trappings of a girlfriend, Luke said. She was possessive and insisted he get off the dating sites he frequented. She wanted him to stop talking to other women, even his friends. After 2 weeks, he told her she needed to go home. She called him several times a day. He didn't pick up when he saw her caller ID, but sometimes she'd get to him through the office staff at work. She'd be really hostile, he said. Like, "What are you doing? Ducking my calls? You don't want to speak to me? Is that how little I meant to you?" Luke's son played in a band, and Dara regularly showed up in the audience with her friends. She came to his house early one morning to get some of her things. She pulled from his closet a few shirts she had bought him and grabbed some shirts that she hadn't. "Some of those are mine," he said. "I'd like to keep them." "They're all mine," she said. "You're not getting them." He followed her out to his front porch, trying to get his shirts back. She started to scream. Then she threw herself down, face first, on the tiled concrete porch floor. She stood up, her nose bleeding. "You hit me! You knocked me down!" she yelled. "I'm calling the cops!" She dialed 911. Two squad cars arrived. Luke and Dara gave their contradictory statements. He tried to stay calm, reasoning that the more rattled he acted, the more he'd seem like a domestic abuser. "I was pretty sure I was going to jail," he said. "I felt like you do when you're in traffic and someone smacks into your car." The police were getting ready to take Luke in when a couple of his neighbors came out and told them they'd seen Dara hurl herself to the floor. The police offered Luke the opportunity to press charges against her for making a false report. Luke gave her the gender pass instead. "No," he said. "I just want her out of here." He has since learned from Facebook, he didn't dare unfriend her, that she was seeing someone else, though she occasionally dropped hints in a status or a comment that she was still interested in him. Near the end of our conversation, he told me that he was in a new relationship, too. "I'm off the deep end with this one," he said. "I'm hoping she's the last love of my life." He confessed that he lived with a steady fear that what had happened with Dara could happen again. "It's deeply affected me. Even though I have a calm demeanor and try to take everything calmly." What happened with Dara, then, was much more than a party story Luke could pull out for laughs. Dara and the hazard she represented was an ongoing source of worry, shaping his emotional landscape. The freewheeling divorcee's existence that he'd been living suddenly seemed treacherous. The contrast between Luke's initial persona of a laid-back guy who could brush off a one-night stand gone awry and that of a man transformed by fear is emblematic of the contradictory state of the male stalking victim. A review of research on male victims of relationship-related stalking, published in the International Journal of Men's Health in 2009, shows these men not only feel that they are less likely to be taken seriously, they also tend to take themselves less seriously. Men will describe stalking acts as frustrating or annoying rather than threatening or frightening. They are less likely to call themselves victims, and they are less likely to contact the police. Yet they confess to being changed by the experience. They may become more cautious and paranoid, or suffer from anxiety and shifts in their attitudes and personality. In these ways, male targets of female stalking are victims, but if no one wants to see them as such, they become invisible, even to themselves. Lang Henriksen Rowling has described several reasons why this is so. Men are generally less likely to get involved with the legal system for a relationship-related problem. Men may feel humiliated if they're afraid of a woman, who is usually smaller and perceived as less dangerous. Certain acts, such as raising a clenched fist, are viewed as dangerous when the aggressor is male and the target female, yet may be considered laughable when the roles are reversed. The tendency to see female stalking or aggression as humorous can backfire, keeping men, and even boys, from getting the support they need. Jerry, a former student of mine, told me that he had been cyber-stalked throughout high school by a girl he was friends with during his freshman year. His friends made fun of her obsessive Facebook posts about him and her repeated efforts to get him to chat over IM by changing her username, which he blocked. "I joined in the laughter," he said. "I didn't want it to be awkward. I didn't want to say I was scared of this girl. Who wouldn't have laughed at me because of that?" At one point, he was so alarmed by her behavior that he confessed his fears to a school guidance counselor. She suggested that he give a photo of the girl to school security. Confiding in the guidance counselor made him feel a little better, and the girl never showed up at his school. But looking back from the vantage point of several years, he said the school should have done more. "I was pretty lucky," he said. "She seemed unhinged. She could have brought a gun to school. And then wouldn't they, school officials, have felt bad that they didn't take me more seriously?" If he had been a girl, he said, everyone would have pounced on the situation. "Because I'm a boy, I'm supposed to take care of these things. But what if I couldn't?" Jerry, in other words, didn't quite fit what Sinclair and other relationship aggression researchers call the good victim prototype. Submissive, frightened women and girls, for instance, are good victims, perceived as deserving of support. Men and teenage boys who are supposed to take care of these things make far less acceptable victims, particularly if they or their peers laugh about their aggressor or act in other ways unfitting to victimhood. Luke, for example, seemed to relish retelling the tantalizing bits of his porch diver story, how willing Dara was to bed him right away, and how, the night after the police made her leave his house, she called to ask him to see her again, just for sex. He told me he was briefly tempted, then turned her down. I said to myself, this woman dove into my concrete and tile porch, bloodied her nose, and called the police on me. This is a woman I don't want in my life. This kind of swagger, says Lang Henriksen Rowling, may be a consequence of men's socialization scripts, which promote the notion that they should be ready to have a sexual experience with any woman at any time. Dara's determined pursuit at once alarmed Luke and gave him a pleasurable ego boost. Two seemingly irreconcilable states, at least for the good victim. In a kind of macho version of slut-shaming, Luke's buddies told him that he let himself in for it by accepting the opportunity to sleep with Dara only hours after they met. Any woman who's going to do that